Who's Talking with DZ Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of shrimp and grits, and Bill Smith's Season to the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin. The Playmakers' latest production and its last production for this season is Cyrano de Bergerac, which has a large-nosed sword-fighting Cyrano dominating a cast of seemingly hundreds of other actors. I'm told that it's really just about 30. But the Cyrano who dominates the stage is played by our own Ray Dooley, who has agreed to join us and talk about this wonderful play. Ray, thanks for coming.
DG, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Well, I talked to Joseph Hodge, who's the director, who said that this wonderful, spectacular play, or pageant, I guess it could almost be, in the sense that it is so full of life and action and parades and sword fighting, and but that the role of Cyrano is so demanding, sword fighting, athleticism, running back and forth, in addition to Cyrano's character as a poet. It must sound like a poet and someone who ages on the stage and must play different things. There are only a handful of actors who can be called upon to play this role in a production like this. And he said Ray Dooley is one of them. And when I got a chance to do it, I couldn't turn it down with Ray Dooley being available. All right, I'm going to ask you to talk, but, but getting all of this out, I then said, well, could you name for me the others who, other than Ray, who might be able to play this part? And he fumbled around a little bit, but he just never got around to naming anybody other than the people who played in the movies, Cyrano.
Right.
So what do you think? I mean, how do you feel when somebody talks about you like that?
Well, I respect Joe greatly, and I guess two things occur. One is I'm, of course, very flattered and appreciative of his comments. But the other thing, and it's not – I don't really mean to make it sound false modesty, but in a sense I'm just doing my job, which is, you know, I'm with the dramatic art department at UNC Chapel Hill, and they wouldn't have hired me if I didn't have some ability. And sometimes I'm called upon at Playmakers to play a smaller role. And that's good. And sometimes the job is, particularly if you're cast as Cyrano, to sort of put the play on your back and carry it. And I've been doing this a long time now, nearly, just about 30 years professionally. And fortunately, I've gotten to the point where I can still do that. This kind of a golden window when you're old enough to and good enough to do it, and when you're still
your
young
knees
enough.
Replaced you.
Exactly, exactly. Knees,
I'm thinking
ankles.
I'm beyond that. I wish, looking back, I wish I could. That is the prime of life, isn't it? We think of the prime of life being at 16 or 25 or something like that, but it
That's
is
right.
when you are have been around long enough to be. To have learned your craft and to have sensitivity to it and at the same time have the physical strength to do these kinds of things.
Yeah, I sometimes think there's real validity in the old apprentice journeyman, master craftsman, way of looking at life. And when I was in acting school back in my early 20s and then, maybe for the first 3 or 4 years out of acting school, I was sort of an apprentice. And then maybe the next 8 years or so, I felt like a journeyman. And when I was 35 years old, I had the great privilege and good fortune to play Hamlet for the first time. I played it twice. But when I finished that, and it went okay, and I thought to myself, well, I guess maybe that was, in a sense, a kind of masterwork of my craft. And I started to believe that maybe I actually knew what I was doing. The great British actor John Gielgud once commented that, in his opinion, it took 20 years before you actually began to understand what acting was. And now that I'm heading on toward 30 years, I think he really said something. I think that's true, particularly if you're going to challenge yourself with the great classic roles, the Shakespeare's, the Moliere's, something like Cyrano, and there are others. But if you're going to make an attempt at that, it does take an awful long time to develop the skills physically, verbally, intuitively, and then to be of an age where the issues facing the character are issues that perhaps you yourself have faced in life. And so you have the ability to bring your own experience to these great, great issues. You know, they used to be on Ben Casey, what was it, birth, death, man, woman, birth, death, infinity. You know, that sort of to those things. And when you can put all that package together, there is a kind of golden time. And I'm beginning to see the sun set, but it's still pretty golden here.
Well, it is interesting. So that the, you know, we hear, those of us who are on the outside of the drama world, hear the different theories of acting and drama and how you train actors.
Yep.
And some of the training vehicles do depend very much on the, on incorporating and taking advantage of the actor's own experiences.
Yep.
So that what you're saying is, if it's sort of like a young writer who may have great talent at writing,
yep,
but hadn't had anything to write about yet other than his teenage years.
Yes.
And that the actor, the more he or she builds up the experience,
yes,
from living,
yes,
has more to put into playing different roles.
Yes, if you are the kind of actor who attempts to do that, and I hope that I am, and
all right,
certainly.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
I mean, what can you define what in your own life contributes to your being able to be a poet and a swordsman on stage and convey that effectively, or are you just going through the motions of doing what the director tells you to do?
Well, it's a collaboration always with the director. A good director gets to know the actor and gets to know what he has to work with. How physically competent are you? How verbally competent are you? What kind of emotional life can you bring to the piece? What kind of intellectual acuity can you bring to the piece, and then works with the actor to make the most of those abilities. And Joe and I worked together last year on Not About Heroes, which was a World War I play, which was a very moving play, and also gave me a chance to exercise some fairly, you know, fairly deep things that came up, but it didn't ask for the kind of physical,
right,
life that Cyrano asks for. The physical life comes. I've always been athletic, and fortunately, when I was a young actor, I was in a production of Cyrano in Baltimore in 1980 that starred F. Murray Abraham as Cyrano. And the theater, for a week, the first week of rehearsals was split between morning sessions with the top speech and voice guy in the country, a guy named Tim Monick from Juilliard School, who now only does movies. And in the afternoons, we had a three-hour session with B.H. Barrie, the great British fight director and teacher of stage combat, one of the two people who really brought that whole craft from England to the United States in the 1970s into the 80s. And I had a chance to study with Barrie there and later in private lessons with him as well in New York. So I've always been very much...
You like that kind of stuff?
I do, very much. And in acting training...
Let me just interrupt just for a second. Please hold on to that thought. But
sure,
just for people who might be listening to this conversation, wondering what we're talking about, the playmaker Cyrano is just full of fighting. And it's you are worried as you watch this about people killing each other, which they
yeah,
seem to do very effectively. But mm-hmm, a lot of sword fighting and no room for mistakes. I'm enchanted with this craft. So
yeah,
when you see the playmakers play, which it is, I don't want to disparage the rest of it, but it's worth seeing just to watch the sword fights.
Yeah,
and you're telling us how you learned this craft.
Yes, and we had the great good fortune to have a fight director from Canada. She's actually an American woman who married a Canadian. Well, actually, he's Welsh, but they live in Canada. And she assists at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival in Canada. She's the assistant. We were going to have the actual fight director himself, but a week before rehearsals were to begin, he was doing a stunt, a 40 or 60-foot fall, and he missed. And he now is directing the next fight from a wheelchair while his leg is pieced back together. So the question was what to do, and we brought his assistant down, a woman named Kara Wooten, and she was absolutely terrific. And a number of our company, most of our company really had had no experience with this, and she was very patient and she taught very well and got everybody up to a reasonable speed. And we've created, she created and put on us as a choreographer puts on dances, these fights. And then we invest believability and we act through the fights. And that's what creates the effect for the audience.
Well, I guess it is like choreographing a dance.
Absolutely.
Every, although it looks like a disorderly fight, every swing is...
Every move
is programmed in advance.
Absolutely.
By the fight director.
Somebody in that position is either called a fight director, a fight arranger, a fight master. Sometimes they go by different names, but it's the person who is responsible for the choreography of the fighting sequences, whether it's sword fighting, hand to hand, punches, slaps, that sort of thing. It's a subspecialty in our field. Very few people can earn a living at it, but most particularly large Shakespeare companies, for example, will have a fight director or a fight master who is responsible for choreographing the fights, for teaching the company how to do combat safely, and also for the maintenance of the weapons.
Well, I'm talking to Ray Dooley. We're talking about Cyrano de Bergerac, the Playmaker's current production and last production for this season. He and I will be right back.
Do you have anxiety about going to the dentist? At Dr. Robinson's office, we know that it is very common for people to feel nervous about dental work. In fact, many people will put off going to the dentist because they are afraid. But having regular dental cleanings and oral exams is part of your body's overall health. If you are the type of person that avoids the dentist because of anxiety, you could be a candidate for sedation dentistry. For more information about sedation dentistry or to schedule your appointment with Dr. Teresa Robinson, please call 1-800-NEW-GRIN. Do you feel guilty leaving your dog alone all day when you go to work? There's another solution. Doggy Spa and Daycare. Situated on 11 beautiful wooded acres, Doggy Spa and Daycare is a fabulous alternative to leaving Fido home alone. Your dog will get to play outside 3 times per day. And when you come to pick up your furry friend, you'll find a tired and happy dog that has just had a great day. Doggy Spa and Daycare is open 365 days a year and has a dog-loving staff. Visit online at doggyspa.com.
I'm Freddie Kiger, and I'm here to ask your support for Alan Bedour for Superior Court Judge for Orange and Chatham Counties. I'm not a lawyer. I can't speak about civil or criminal cases, but I can speak about Alan the man. For most of my life, I've been a teacher. What a blessing to watch one of your former students create positive good for his community. Alan's done that. I'm proud of not only what he's doing, but the way he's doing it. He's fair, direct, honest. When Alan sees wrong, he wants to right it, and from those who do wrong, he expects accountability. As Superior Court Judge, Alan has found himself. It's a direct extension of his personality that makes the best use of his strengths. Alan is where we need him, and where we will continue to need him as a judge in Superior Court. I respect Alan Bedour for the fairness and justice I know he brings to his courtroom every day. He wants to serve the common good. How refreshing. He simply wants to serve the common good. Please support Alan Bedour for Superior Court Judge. I'm Freddie Kiger, and I thank you.
Paid for by Keep Alan Bedour, Superior Court Judge.
Who's Talking with D.C. Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of Shrimp and Grits, and Bill Smith's Seasoned in the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Ray Dooley. Ray is the playing the lead role in Cyrano de Bergerac, the Playmaker's final production for this season, and a wonderful production it is. With a great cast and a wonderful production, but it's largely on Ray Dooley's shoulders. We've been talking about how you train to become a credible sword fighter, and I think it would be fun to go back more than 100 years to the time when this play was first produced and for the lead actor in this production to tell the playwright that a woman was his coach in sword fighting.
Right.
And that times have changed, haven't they?
They have. And there are a few. There's one that I know of in New York, but Kara certainly has all the skills and has studied art. She actually has her PhD and wrote a book on stage violence and is very athletic and a terrific teacher. And it was a real pleasure to work with.
So. Ray, let me ask you this question, because in many respects, well, for instance, in this role of Cyrano that you play so well, a part of it is a very poetic
yes.
part, which requires the actor to be sensitive, thoughtful. And you don't think of actors having the capability to be sensitive and thoughtful and then go out and be rough and ready and violent or project
yes.
that. And I wonder, I mean, is it hard for these great actors who do have the sensitivity to play these mm-hmm. thoughtful, intellectual roles that require a poetic or intellectual understanding? Is it sometimes difficult to get them to fight on stage?
It is. The famous thing, of course, is operatic tenors. It's kind of a running joke in the industry that, you know, you don't want to give a tenor a sword, you know, because you never know what might happen. But a role like Hamlet or Cyrano, where you've just got to have it all. Those are the roles where you really get tested. Can you? One of the things I was thinking about the other day is with, for example, there's a duel in the first act of Cyrano, where he's making up a poem as he fights. So that's all well and good, but of course, what this means is you do a quick bout of sword fighting, and then instead of stopping to breathe, you start talking. So the question is, when are you going to breathe? Because you have to fight and then you have to talk, which means you can't be taking air in. You have to be expelling air out. And it's very similar in Hamlet, where, of course, the big sword fight comes in Act 5, you know, 3 hours into the play or however long the production is running. And with that as well, there is talking in between the bouts of sword play. And you have to just be in great shape to be able to have the physical activity and then be able to, instead of panting and gasping for breath, turn around and talk lengthy sentences and more, and then find your breath when you can. But it's certainly one of the challenges of the role.
Well, the other challenge in that particular scene where Cyrano is determined to cut down somebody who's insulted,
right,
and wishes to do it also by winning the poetry battle as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another trick that you have to play on the audience is you have to convince them that this would really, you know it really couldn't happen, but you have to convince the audience
yes.
that this is really real, that this is a sword fight. The guy stops, makes up some poetry, gives it to you, and then goes back and wins the duel. I
mean, right.
You have to persuade us to suspend. Is it disbelief?
Suspend disbelief. That's Coleridge, right? Absolutely. Suspend disbelief.
I found that I've suspended disbelief very easily and smoothly. But if it seems to me that it could very easily have gone the other way, and I would just kind of be laughing and saying, "This is so stupid. I can't go along with this,"
yeah.
and so I don't believe it, and I'm not.
Well, two things on that. One is that Joe, our director, very carefully staged that along with the fight director. But the other thing is it's the reaction of the crowd that sells it. If they are involved.
You mean the stage crowd or the
stage crowd. Mm-hmm. The stage crowd, the other people on the stage who are witnessing this duel. And if they are involved and acting well and spontaneously and with professional attention to detail and size, then the world seems coherent. If they're standing around doing nothing and we're knocking our brains out, there's an incoherence then that reads false to the audience. So Joe rehearsed that scene, much to my knees, unhappiness, and my ankles. He rehearsed that duel a lot for the crowd reactions. And it's the same thing in a production of Julius Caesar, where Brutus and Mark Antony can be giving their great orations, And if the crowd is just standing there like a wet rag, it dies. So having played the crowd in Caesar several times and supported in Cyrano several times, I know how important and exhausting that is. And our folks are doing a good job with
it. It's so interesting, and I don't mean to turn this towards politics, but in my experience in politics, I learned that at the meetings where we politicians give these talks, which are, when you look at them, it's unbelievable how dull they could be. But if you have an audience, you have four or five people scattered in the audience who are genuinely enthusiastic about it and willing to convey that enthusiasm by applauding and laughing and saying amen at the right times, then all of a sudden the rest of the audience begins to believe that what's spoken is really worthwhile.
Right. It's absolutely.
So you had some plants in the audience on stage that drew us in the audience into what you were doing. Are you thinking?
Yeah. Everyone on stage should be experiencing it, you know, should be acting through the fight and experiencing it as if it were for the first time. And that's a question of professionalism and being present and giving. And Joe rehearsed that a lot.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the story of Cyrano. It's well known, but nevertheless, it's not worth – I mean, it is worth reviewing it because we sometimes forget the details of it. And from your standpoint, now in the middle of the production and having gone through all of the rehearsals, do you still love the story, or are you just so tired of it?
I guess it's a forest for the trees thing. When I think about the part now, I think about the individual moments and the individual challenges. So the overall story I'm seeing from the inside, of course, it's a fantastic story of the man with the large nose who loves the beautiful woman, but because he has a large nose, he can't speak to her, and he meets a very handsome guy that she has fallen in love with, and the handsome guy can't speak very well because he gets tongue-tied in front of beautiful women, so they team up, and Cyrano gives Christian, the other fellow, all this beautiful language because Roxane is what was known at the time as a précieuse, which is to say not only is she a beautiful woman, but she is a very learned woman.
She demands
Yes, and remember, this is the time before, of course, radio or television, so if you could hold forth at a dinner table or in a conversation – you were highly prized, and because there, you know, you could have a string quartet playing in the background, but people talking to people in with wit and verve and in an amusing way was a great social skill and a necessary social skill if you were going to succeed in the world. And for whatever reason, Christian doesn't have this, but Cyrano, excuse me, provides him with these words that Christian then repeats to Roxane, and Roxane believes that Christian is not only handsome, but of course this wonderful poet. And in the fourth act, well, maybe we shouldn't.
The story we know. So don't worry about giving the plot away.
Well, Christian is killed on the battlefield, and Cyrano decides that he will not, out of honor to Christian, he never speaks up and never tells her, "Hey, that was me." He lets Roxane go on believing that Christian was this great soul, as she calls him, for 14 years. And she finally figures it out when Cyrano comes to her at the very – he's been wounded. He's been ambushed and hit over the head, and he's dying. And he comes to her, and she finally, because of various things that happen in the scene, she figures it out. And she has the great line, "I have loved only one man in my life, and I have lost him twice."
Yeah, this makes you cry.
You know.
You can't believe this tear comes in. Don't want anybody to see that you have been moved by this, but it catches you.
Yes, Scott Ross, in his online review of the play, quoted John Simon, the New York theater critic who had said, "Cyrano is not a great play. It is merely a perfect play." And that's, I think that's an argument for that. Certainly is a perfect play.
Well, it's a perfect play that everybody listening should make arrangements to see, because you won't see a production like this very often. With that, let's take a quick break. Ray Dooley and I are talking about Cyrano de Bergerac. We'll be right back.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Grant, official spokesman for Village Pediatrics, located in Southern Village. Do you know what a medical home is? A medical home is not a house or a hospital, but an approach to providing comprehensive primary care that is accessible, family-centered, compassionate, and culturally effective. Village Pediatrics is a medical home for your child that offers same-day appointments and evening and weekend hours. As a very satisfied patient, I highly recommend it. Stop by today. Village Pediatrics, Chapel Hill.
This is Dr. Janelle Williams. Have you considered whether you are at risk for skin cancer? Think of the following. Have you had a severe or blistering sunburn? Do you have blonde or red hair, blue eyes, or freckles? Do you enjoy outdoor activities, or have you spent time lifeguarding? Do you already have irregular moles? Have you spent time in the tanning bed? These can all constitute risk factors for skin cancer or malignant melanoma. One of five Americans will develop skin cancer in their lifetime, and as many as one in 50 Americans will develop malignant melanoma, a very serious skin cancer. Summertime is the perfect time for paying more attention to your skin and to check with your physician for any suspicious spots.
For medical or cosmetic questions about your skin, call Central Dermatology Center at 401-1994 or click on www.cdcskin.com. Central Dermatology is located on Highway 54 near the I-40 Exchange. Central Dermatology, protecting what protects you.
This is Dale Pratt Wilson with the Coalition for Alcohol and Drug-Free Teenagers of Chapel Hill and Carrboro with this message.
My name's Rachel, and I'm 10 years old. I like riding my bike, playing soccer, and in 8 years, I'll be an alcoholic. I'll start drinking in middle school, just at parties. My friends will drink, so I will too.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
My parents won't really know what's going on yet. I mean, I'll do okay in school, but when I drink, I'll do some things I don't really want to do. So by the time my parents talk to me about it, alcohol won't be my only problem.
Alcohol affects their judgment and their future, so start talking before they start drinking.
My parents won't believe it could happen to me.
For more information on teens and alcohol, and to learn what you can do, visit the web at stopalcoholabuse.gov.
Thanks, WCHL, for your support.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of shrimp and grits, and Bill Smith's Seasoned to the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Ray Dooley, who plays Cyrano, and I are talking about the Playmakers production of Cyrano de Bergerac. Ray, wonderful story. And Joseph Hodge told me that at the end of the first, of the opening night at, in Paris, more than 100 years ago,
yes,
that there were like 40 curtain calls or something like that, that
yes,
this play took yeah, Paris by storm.
Yes, it did.
And what is it that made it so powerful in those times, mm, and how much of that translates into these, or it can be translated into current times?
Yeah. Our dramaturg, Adam Versenya, has a very fine essay in the program. One of the things he mentioned when we were beginning rehearsals was that Rostand wrote this play in a sense for the French to be given back a sense of honor after a terrible loss to the Prussians in the Franco-Prussian War. And they were feeling, so Adam told us, they were feeling, that terrible defeat. And then to bring in this play, which harks back to the 17th century, it's set in the 17th century, and to restore, to see this great friend. He was a historical figure, this fellow Cyrano de Bergerac.
This is a fictionalized version, but of a real person.
Of a real person. And you can go to the library and get out his works and that sort of thing. And it would be, I guess the analogy would be if America as, of course, France is a much more heterogeneous, yeah, homogeneous. I'm sorry. There's a similarity. A smaller country.
At least that time, it was all the French people.
Exactly. French. Yes. Very French. And so maybe with a common mind, or common feelings be a little different today. But if somebody wrote a play about George Washington and the American Revolution, that might be in some way analogous or something, or reading David McCullough's 1776, you know, in that sort of way. And the sense of a community being, I don't know if you want to say redeemed or at least rejuvenated through harking back to this time of great glory and this figure of maybe the personification of panache, as he speaks of in the French, this spirit of honor and glory and self-sacrifice and this noble soul, is some of the translations have it. And perhaps the people who were there on opening night felt that they had been given back a sense of honor, national honor.
Real Cyrano have this big nose, or was that something that
apparently Rostand? Yes, apparently he did. I'm sure Rostand has, you know, made much of it, but apparently he did. Yes.
Well, it leads me to the other thing that I think folks who've seen the play wonder about, and that those who will see it will wonder about as well, and that is. Who decides how big the nose is and how is it applied? And can you tell us the story of Cyrano's nose as it affects the actor?
Way back in September, Joe was here with our costume designer, Marion Williams, who's a UNC graduate, as a matter of fact, and with our costume craftsperson, Tracy Meek, and the four of us met, and Tracy would be charged with making the mask, making the nose. And we discussed general ideas, like did we want it to be really grotesque or did we want it to be believable but a little large? And we came up with an idea that we didn't want it to be a joke, like a Pinocchio nose, that it should be large.
You mean not like 10 feet out?
Exactly,
or something.
Exactly. That it should be large but still believable. And Tracy started by making a mask of my face with the plaster of Paris, which is really remarkable. The second time I've had it done, and you get all this wet clay put on your face with two little straws up your nose so you can breathe. And off of that mask then that she made, she built a nose that we looked at and we all liked very much. So the nose had been taken care of, and it's made out of rubber, I should say, and it's hollow. And it goes onto my nose with spirit gum, which is a kind of glue, a theatrical glue that we're all very used to using. And a wonderful thing is that from the first rehearsal that I used it, and I did use it through rehearsals, we never got a note on it. In other words, to say, well, it doesn't look quite right, or it just was accepted, and everybody accepted it, and it's been great. I have four of them on my dressing table, and I go in at night, and I see which one looks in good shape and which one needs some makeup touch-ups, and I'll pick one for that night and put it on, and I wear it. And then those people who know me, my beard right now is, as you can see, DG, is snowy white. And for the first four acts of the play, our play is broken into a first act and second act, but for the first four acts of Rustan's play, I have dark hair color in my beard. So it looks brown, and I'm wearing a long wig.
So the beard is real but colored.
Real but colored. And then between Rustan's Act 4 and Act 5 is 14 years. So I take the wig off and come back out with my own very sparse hair, and we take the color out of the beard. And so there's an aging that goes on, very easily done.
I guess those of us who've got a little bit of hair on top but it's all white would like to borrow your beard coloring that you use in the first four acts.
It's very handy. It looks like a little bottle that has a little wand in it, and you just put it right on.
This was my impression, and I wonder if you all have talked about it, but I think if there was anything that kind of threatened the credibility of the whole story, it was that as we got to know and kind of like Cyrano, that nose sort of disappeared. It wasn't big enough to remind us that it's really big, but we said, this is a nice guy. Well, that's a big nose, but still, he looks pretty good.
Well, that's what his friend says. You know, because there's a girl who's selling drinks and eats at the theater in the first act of Rostand's play, who, you know, is obviously very taken with him. And And so there really is a psychological edge to it as well. Anybody with a feature that they think is unattractive and what that does to you psychologically. And there's a, you know, a long discussion to be had about
Let's have some of that discussion because it came to me how much, you know, if I ever see myself in the, objectively, the same thing we hear our voices.
Sure.
It's just awful. Or we see a picture of ourselves or a movie or something of ourselves see these distinct awful features, or at least in my case, you see all these things, and you think, how in the world could anybody love this?
Yep.
Well, other people have even more striking deformities. But what I realized in watching Cyrano is that all of us, every one of us, even the most beautiful, most handsome people, have something that they're not satisfied with about their appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to, you have to come to deal with it one way or another.
Absolutely. And one of the questions that we I asked myself and explored is he using it as an excuse? Because he really is afraid of being rejected. And
he can accept being rejected because of his nose, exactly. But not about something else.
Exactly. And people keep saying, you know, talk to her. And in the fourth act, Christian tells him that there's a series of plot twists where Roxanne tells Christian that she would love him even if he were ugly or grotesque. And Cyrano can't accept hearing that. And he's about to try to tell her when something else happens, and he can't. But interestingly, I think in every production, this is the fourth time I've been in Cyrano, the first time I played it. But everybody at least once says, gee, I wonder what it would be like if we just didn't do a nose and I just played it with a regular nose.
And that it was an it was his
exactly.
Some of that came across
exactly.
in the way you all did the production.
And I think the reason that Joe and Marion wanted the believable nose is so that people might just ask that question, like, "Gee, it's big, but it's not that big, and he's got so many other good attributes."
Well, that's exactly what's happened. That's interesting, and all of these things. I wonder what other questions there were that you all put out for us that we haven't gotten to yet. We'll try to do that after this break. Talking to Ray Dooley about Cyrano de Bergerac. We'll be right back.
WCHL 1360. Time now for Biography for Radio with Jack Perkins. Brought to you locally by the Cedars and East-West Partners Community.
He was well into his 30s when he learned the truth about his family. It was scarier than a Hollywood movie. His story next on Biography for Radio.
Former Nesquik powder users are telling us why they switched to rich chocolate Ovaltine.
My girls don't like to drink white milk, and the only way I could get them to drink it was with chocolate milk. I'd seen on TV that Ovaltine has extra vitamins in it. Now I'm using it, and my girls love the taste. And they're drinking their milk, getting their calcium, and all the vitamins from Ovaltine. I stopped using Nesquik because it just doesn't have the vitamins that Ovaltine has.
Ovaltine. Try it for the nutrition. Keep buying it for the taste.
More Ovaltine, please!
He was born in New York in the late 1930s, but until 1974, he thought he was born in the place he grew up, Neptune, New Jersey. A journalist checking his background told him the truth. The woman the Hollywood star had thought of as his mother was actually his grandmother. To avoid scandal, she had raised him as her own after his birth to her teenage daughter. Even more shocking, his true mother was the person he had known as his sister for 37 years. He was stunned when he got the call, but by that time, nothing could stop him. He had started humbly, with roles in school plays and bit parts on TV. He even delivered messages for MGM. But directors soon discovered this was an actor who could be arrogant, frightening, and insanely charming all at once. Now we know him as the 3-time Oscar and 7-time Golden Globe winner for such films as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, The Shining, Something's Gotta Give, and countless others. With his Cheshire Cat grin and Devil May Care attitude, he is Hollywood star Jack Nicholson. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&D.
Bye. Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by The Cedars of Chapel Hill and East West Partners Community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at The Cedars of Chapel Hill.
This is Congressman Mel Watt, and I'm supporting Adam Stein for Superior Court Judge. Growing up during the Civil Rights Movement, I saw people risk their careers and even their lives to bring equal opportunity to all Americans. Among those heroes is my former law partner, Adam Stein. At a time when North Carolina had separate drinking fountains for blacks and whites, Adam Stein joined Julius Chambers to form the first integrated law firm in North Carolina, fighting for civil rights across the state. When their law office was firebombed, they refused to back down. Adam Stein has fought for justice and equality his entire life. He's one of our country's finest attorneys who's open-minded, honest, and fair. Adam Stein, unmatched legal experience, a life dedicated to justice. Please vote Adam Stein for Superior Court Judge on May 2nd.
Paid for by Adam Stein for Superior Court Judge Committee.
Who's Talking with D.Z. Martin is brought to you by Crook's Corner, home of Shrimp and Grits, and Bill Smith's Seasoned in the South menu. Join us at 610 West Franklin. Daily menu at crookscorner.com.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Ray Dooley, who plays Cyrano in Cyrano de Bergerac, the playmaker's current production, and I are talking about this play and all the kinds of things that come up. Ray, Cyrano de Bergerac was written in French.
Yes.
So in order to put it on in America, you could put it on in French, and you all did. You put more French in it than I could understand.
Yes, that was Joe's idea. Yeah, we sure did.
But nevertheless, it is basically in English, so you got to search around for an English translation. And then it says on the cover of the program that it's not only directed by Joseph Hodge, but adapted by him.
Yes.
And I wonder how – surely there have got to be mixed feelings about doing something new with a play from the canon.
Yes.
Or a new translation of the Bible or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, absolutely. It's,
sure. And not only a new translation, but then some editing along
absolutely.
The way.
Absolutely. Yep.
How does this kind of operation take place, and how do you do it in a way that's faithful to dramatic traditions?
In this case, there the most famous translation of the play, and one that I've been in twice, is by a man named Brian Hooker. It's from the 1920s, and it's extremely flowery and densely written. Rostand's original is all in rhyming couplets in French, and Anthony Burgess wrote a version which is all in rhyming English, and I was in that version in Baltimore.
Who is the guy who does Molière's?
That's Richard Wilbur.
Richard Wilbur.
Okay. Yes, who then writes? He writes the Molière's Molière wrote in verse. He has translated into English verse brilliantly. So I'd been in these two other translations, and there are other things about the Burgess translation, although it's wonderfully witty. He makes some major changes. Roxanne does not show up on the battlefield in Act 4. That's the main one.
So he's made an adaptation.
Oh, yes.
Significant.
Absolutely.
In his translation.
Absolutely. Joe read, I think, every translation that there is, and I read about six of them, including one that takes place in modern-day Glasgow, written in a Scottish dialect.
Glaswegian or something.
In Glaswegian dialect, rife with profanity, and it's actually a very lively and muscular piece of writing, but it probably works better in Scotland than it would here. Joe's idea, finally, he went to the Project Gutenberg website on the web, you know, that where
public domain. Everything for free.
Absolutely. And there were, lo and behold, at least two translations of Cyrano done just a year or two after the play was done in English, one in verse and one in prose. And he took those two public domain translations and cut and paste, and he made some adaptations. We've got a bunch of characters who are put together into one character, and he cut Act One heavily. Cyrano in the original doesn't come on for a good 15 minutes into the play. In our version, I come on about 3 minutes into it. And he put this version together. He added a few small things. We have a little – there's a little musical moment that actually I sort of invented with some music that one of our graduate students provided. And we've made an adaptation of this play and cut one enormous section from Act Three, the balcony scene where Cyrano encounters his archenemy, Count de Guiche, and talks for about 10 minutes about the various ways he flew up to the moon, and just it goes on forever. So in order to give our audience a reasonable evening in the theater and get them out in good time. Actually, interestingly, our Cyrano is running shorter than God's Man in Texas, our previous play, right now. Joe adapted and cut and really tried to get right to the essence of each scene and put in enough so that the audience knows what's going on and follows the story, but took out a lot of the detail and the flourishes and the filigree that is in the Rustan and certainly in the Brian Hooker. So it's that's what he did, and it was adapted for our company, our size, our resources. If we were the Royal Shakespeare Company, probably he would adapt it differently, but we're not. We do what we do. And if we were a little, you know, small theater that had a little stage that was maybe, you know, 12 feet by 20 feet, he would have adapted it differently again. But it was written for our stage, for our company, for our capabilities.
Well, Ray, you'd never do this with Shakespeare, would you? I mean, you'd seldom do it with Shakespeare. You'd have more questions to answer, I guess.
Well, you wouldn't change the words. Rarely would you do that. Be ill-advised, or you better have a good reason. But what you might do is cut the text. You know, like a good example was 2 years ago when we did the 3.5-hour uncut folio version of King Lear, and then we did the 90-minute one-act version on alternate nights. You know, we cut King Lear basically in half and presented it in a long
Gave the audience a choice.
Again, and then said to the audience, you know, you like your King Lear 3.5 hours, come see this one. You want to just see, you know, a shorter evening in the theater, come and see the 90-minute version.
It's interesting because we're going to stop talking about Cyrano and You're Wonderful. I hate to do it because there's so much more to talk about in this play, and anybody's listening, this is one not to miss. But there is a challenge in drama today as our expectations about how long we will sit in a seat to see a production. You can see that the movies are, you know, pushing down towards an hour almost, you know, I mean, 80 minutes or something like that.
Yep.
That our expectations are such that the plays that were written 300, 400, 200, 100, and even 50 years ago seem to be too long for many of our audiences generally to appreciate. I mean, you get tired quicker, and it's a real challenge, isn't it, for you guys?
Yes, but. Peter Brook, the great British director, says that, you know, if something is boring, it's not the audience's fault. The performers just have to make it better. We did a school matinee last Thursday morning, I guess it was, for high school students. And I think both Chapel Hill and East Chapel Hill students were there, among others. And they loved it. They were not restless. They got it. They got it so much. I mean, this love story with the fighting and this. It's a wonderful piece of work. And you know, interestingly, the 3.5-hour King Lear is the last show that I can remember at our theater that sold out. And so people are willing to come.
If you keep them excited and interested in some fashion.
Absolutely. And Mark Wing Davies' production of Lear, you know, not everybody liked it, but that you certainly were never bored. Let me put it that way. And it was a brilliant piece of theater. And theater can be very provocative sometimes, and that was a very provocative production. But it sold out. And people came to see it, and many people loved it. And Cyrano is doing very well. And the big Brook takes his company to perform for students and children. And it's always, I think, a great test if young children including up to high school age, are interested, you're doing something right.
Wow.
And these students were, they were one of our best audiences. Fantastic.
Well, Ray Dooley, you're doing something right with Cyrano, because you sure kept me excited all the way through.
Thanks,
and I share that with East Chapel Hill and Chapel Hill High School students. Thanks for doing it. Thanks particularly for taking time from an incredibly busy schedule as you wind up your teaching load and also prepare for tonight's production.